This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Joyful, joyful.
You're in the Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. This is the show where we talk about spirituality and sexuality for our community.
Good evening, faithful listeners. You're listening to the Spirit Lounge here on Joy 94.9 every Thursday from 8 until 9. I'm Tal Meritz, and I don't have any co-hosts this week, actually, but tonight I will be joined by Andre. Andre's actually from the Online Hate Prevention Institute. Hello, Andre.
Hello, Tal. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And later on, we'll be talking a little bit about online hate, what to do about it, a little bit about what the Institute does. It's very interesting stuff, actually, or at least I thought so, and I thought so enough to actually bring him on. But first we'll be talking about Ramadan, which is our holy day of the week this week. And the reason it's this week, really in many ways it's the holy day of the month, because, of course, Ramadan goes for one entire month. So of all the times that it's starting, it's actually starting tonight. So tonight's the 18th of June is when it's starting. It will continue until the 16th of July. And it usually goes on for about 29 or 30 days, but it depends slightly on where it is around the world, about what country it is, because it's physically when, according to the moon rising, and about when it's in that right position. So sometimes it actually changes slightly country to country because of the positioning in different parts of the world. Unless, of course, I was actually reading, unless you happen to live in Alaska or something where it's like six months daytime, and of course you'll never see the moon, people actually then measure it according to when Mecca would observe Ramadan. So that's the way that one works. Basically, Ramadan is the time when it's to commemorate when the Quran was first revealed to the Prophet Muhammad, and this is how people do it. And of course, it's fasting is a part of coming closer to God, but also at this time it promotes empathy for the needy. It's also a good time when people are encouraged to pray extra, maybe be more pious during this time. It's a time to be extra mindful of God for Muslims. But apart from fasting, people generally go about their daily lives. This is certainly not a month off. And so, you know, it's not, yeah, in no way is this a month off. But also this fasting covers a bit more than just not eating and consuming drink from sunrise to sunset. It actually sometimes will also encapsulate that, you know, extra mindful not to be swearing or fighting or doing things like that, and also actually to refrain from sexual relations during the day. But obviously people are not eating, certainly it's not a case of people not eating for a month straight. When you say a month fast, sometimes people get a bit like, how is that even possible? What's going on is it's from sunrise to sunset. So you'll generally see that people will be eating, obviously, before the sun rises, and then they will break the fast afterwards each day. The name, actually, of the morning one is Sahur. So if you do, of course, see people eating, you know, if you happen to be walking around just before sunrise and happen to see large groups of people eating together and such, it's a good chance that they are Muslim and suddenly I lost my words. I'm sorry for that. And they are probably observing Ramadan, and that's Sahur, which is that morning one. So if you do come across anyone that you know, please bless them a Ramadan Mubarak. That's a blessed Ramadan. And I've actually I've got a song that I'm going to play for this one, our first song, which is by Mahi Zayn, and that's Ramadan. and it's the Arabic version because I saw an English one and an Arabic one, but I thought we'd go with the Arabic one. So that's Mahi Zayn with Ramadan, and I wish everyone a Ramadan Mubarak.
Ramadan, Ramadan, laytaka dawman qareeb, laytaka dawman qareeb.
You're listening to The Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9 every Thursday from 8 until 9. And I'm going to be talking to Andre Obler. He is the CEO of the Online Hate Prevention Institute. Welcome, Andre.
Thank you again.
And before we actually get started, I mean, we were just talking about Ramadan, and obviously as soon as I went to the song and such, you were like, but what about iftar dinners? I'm going to some. So why don't you actually take us through, because you're going to one or two, what an iftar dinner actually is as part of Ramadan.
Okay, so as you mentioned, Ramadan is a fast that lasts from the morning until the evening. And the iftar dinner occurs in the evening when people break the fast. So normally people would do this in family groups or with friends, etc. But the Muslim community also gets together quite often. So different groups within the community would hold an iftar dinner. And it's become a bit of a tradition, if you like, to hold some of these with the wider community. So the Muslim community uses it as an opportunity to invite those other organizations and other community groups and, you know, leaders within the community to come and join them. So I'm attending one at Monash University that the student society there is holding, and another one which is happening with politicians at a different point.
Absolutely wonderful. So you're the CEO of the Online Hate Prevention Institute. Why don't you actually start by just telling us what that institute does or is?
Okay, so we're an independent charity is the first thing. We're not part of a university. We get people thinking we are sometimes. No, we're an independent charity. Specifically, we're a harm prevention charity, which means that we're there to try and keep people safe. We deal specifically, as the name says, with online content. So what we're doing is trying to stop actual harm, physical harm, emotional harm, mental harm occurring to people as a result of what occurs online.
So what would actually constitute as online hate?
Well, it ranges from attacks against groups in society, and that can be different sorts of hate against many different groups, through to cyberbullying against individuals, through to things like trolling, where the serious trolling we deal with can involve people trying to push others towards suicide.
And so how did the institute actually start?
We're 3.5 years old now, and prior to that we had a project for 2 years, which was based in the Zionist Federation of Australia and dealt just with the topic of anti-Semitism. And after 2 years of doing that, we decided that, you know what, we're leading the world in this particular area, but there's a lot of other forms of hate out there, and we need to take the expertise we've got from dealing with anti-Semitism and expand it out to help all those other groups that are also being attacked. So we started the Online Hate Prevention Institute, got our charitable status, set up a board to oversee it, and since then we've been slowly growing and taking on new challenges.
So in many ways, OHPI actually has Jewish roots in terms of its foundation.
Very much. At the moment, our board is 6/10 Jewish, 4/10 not Jewish.
So it's nearly half Jewish, but in that, except not referring to people.
It started in the Jewish community. We're still largely supported from the Jewish community. We are a charity. We take public donations, but a lot of that is coming from the Jewish community still. And some of our directors are still founding directors. They've been there since the start. As new people come on board, we're expanding our diversity. Also, you know, we've got a diverse staff and, diverse supporters on Facebook, Twitter, etc. And we cover a diverse range of issues.
But you actually, yeah, certainly you do cover a whole range of issues. I thought, seeing you did bring that up, I thought I might, I sort of took a little list down of some of the main ones that I saw. Obviously, racism, anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim, hate against Indigenous Australians, hate against military veterans, also serious trolling, cyberbullying, griefing, misogyny, and of course, homophobia. I thought that seeing you guys do so much to do with religious hate and also homophobia, I thought it would be really appropriate to obviously bring you on to the Spirit Lounge, because we cover both issues of sexuality and spirituality. But yeah, that is quite a wide topic. It really is. When we're talking about online hate, it's almost everything there.
Yeah, and look, when you start expanding it out to covering things like cyberbullying, someone could be attacked for no reason whatsoever. I mean, it's just a personal attack. They're not a member of any particular group. They might not have done anything to trigger it. Someone's just got it in for them. And we see a fair bit of that too. You know, we've had requests come through from different parts of government. We've had requests from police for assistance. More recently, we've been doing a little bit of work in the countering violence extremism area, which is what we're now calling the counterterrorism type of work. So, you know, it expands into us dealing with threats from ISIS or, you know, groups like that that are actually targeting people in Australia. That also comes under online hate.
So why does that sort of online hate matter?
Why does it matter? Well, you know, sticking to the, you know, the first example there, when you've got children who are committing suicide, some of them, you know, 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds, quite young, committing suicide through to young adults, and older people as well, and it's really coming from attacks online. It's coming from the constant barrage of abuse that they get that they can't really get away from. You know, people say, okay, well, just get rid of your Facebook account, get rid of your Twitter. Why do you need it? You know, as you'll know, nowadays, if you're not connected, you're out of the loop. You're not part of society. You're not able to function. So, you know, at the extreme end, why do we deal with it? Because it stops people dying, but it also makes society a more inclusive and safer place, and that's what we're aiming to do. Our aim is to make the online hate as unacceptable as hate is in the real world. That doesn't mean we get rid of it entirely, but it does mean we don't give it a free pass just because it's on the internet.
So what sort of, how does OHPI, I was trying to remember. I kept saying OPHI in my head for some reason. But how does OHPI actually do that? Is it research or is it lobbying, or how do they engage in these things?
Both, and other things as well. So to take two examples which aren't on our, a lot of our content's on our website, ohpi.org.au, but a lot of the more serious stuff is not there. And the reason for that is because it might be very closely tied to attacks on individuals. And putting it up there, either you put it up there and everything is sort of blacked out so you can't see any details and it's useless, or you put it out there and it increases the damage to that person. Even if the issue's been dealt with, they don't want to be continuously seen as being the person that was the victim of that attack.
Mm-hmm.
So to give, you know, two recent examples, very similar. Some of the far-right groups went and found Muslim people in the community, put their name, their address, their photograph up on Facebook and said something should be done about this person. And that then gets shared thousands of times, which means hundreds of thousands of people are seeing it. You know, we get phone calls from some of these people that are being targeted saying, you know, I'm fearful, my family is afraid, what can we do? So what we do is first, before we do anything else, we document it. Okay, so we take screenshots of things, we copy addresses, we look up the underlying ID numbers and things, how long things have been online. As soon as we've done that, we, in a case like that, we would contact the platform provider. So we've got direct contact with people at Facebook and YouTube and Google and Twitter. So we contact the relevant platform provider and talk to a real person, because we can do that, and we say, look,
really? That's such a rare gift.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's the advantage of being an organisation that focuses in this area. We actually have those contacts. you know, and even if we don't, we know they're watching our page. You know, we've commented on things that they've disallowed our advertising, and suddenly we get an email from someone at Facebook saying, no, no, the reason we did it was because of this, and if you just change it like this, we'll let it through. So, yeah, they do watch it as well. You know, we would contact them and we would say, here's the details. This needs to come down quickly, because the longer it's up there, the more risk there is that someone's going to actually attack these people. And it might not be any, you know, it might not be anyone related to the person that posted it. It could just be someone who's mentally unbalanced who saw this and decided to, you know, go and take the law into their own hands. So we'll talk to them. We then talk to the police, whether it's state police or federal police. And for a case like that, we usually also pass it on to the Attorney General's Department. And part of that is just so that the government at senior levels are aware of exactly what's going on, so they can take appropriate action to try and reduce the risk of these sorts of things happening.
So there's also, you are engaged, I guess, with policy changes when it comes to these. I don't mean on a government level. I think we'll just start with Facebook and Twitter and things like that.
Look, we're sitting in a very interesting spot. We're 50% human rights organisation, and we're 50% technical startup. So we're a startup. We have the technical expertise, and we have the expertise in the different types of hate we deal with. What we do with that is we try and find technical solutions where the platforms might not be doing something the best way possible. An example we keep pushing Facebook on is, if you've ever gone to report something, there's an option there that says, do you want to send a message? And it does clearly say the message will go to the owner of the page you're trying to report. But people that are reporting are often quite distressed. They're not reading things clearly. They write something like, Facebook, take away this horrible page, turn it off. And the person who's running the page sees this. They're anonymous. You don't know who they are, but you've just told them who you are. And then what happens is they might go and look at the person's page, and because you message them, your page has opened all its privacy settings, so they can now see where you work, who your family are, pictures of your kids, etc. And the problem you've got is they can then start harassing and bullying you. So we've said to Facebook, this option just shouldn't be there, or if it is there, make it pop up something saying, are you sure you really want to do this? Because the number of times we've seen people get themselves in trouble and become a victim of attacks because they've tried to do the right thing and report something is huge. So, yeah, technical suggestions like that we make to the platforms, but we do also do policy work with government suggesting changes. We do a number of reports, and in all our reports we put recommendations for different stakeholders, and that can range from law reform through to these technical changes as well, through to things the public can do to try and address some of the issues.
What are the other sort of changes that you think some of the social media platforms could take on?
There's one which we were talking to Twitter about last week. One of the problems we have is if police get a report of something, they write to the platform and they say, here is the item. We would like the IP address of the person that's running this account. Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, whatever it is. Once police get the IP address, they can see who the internet connectivity provider is, okay, your Telstra or your Optus, whoever it is. They can go to that company and say, we would like the customer's details. We would like their street address and their name, so we can go and talk to them, or we can charge them, or whatever it is. The problem is the platforms will only give the IP address if the IP address is from the same legal jurisdiction, the same country, or maybe the same state as the police officer that's asking for it.
Right.
So we have a problem. Okay, if someone is in Melbourne using a proxy that's in the US, which changes their IP address, so it looks like they're coming from the US, attacking another person in Melbourne, the police in Melbourne can't get the IP address. They can't even get the IP address of the proxy to go to the proxy and say, what's the real IP address? Because they won't tell them that. So our suggestion there... Yeah,
so you would have to be from the... You'd have to find police from the proxy if you knew what that was, which they don't.
And that's the problem. They don't. They might have a good relationship with those police, but they'd have to literally write to every police force in the world and get them all to put in the same request for the same item, which is huge overkill and just isn't going to happen.
No.
Right? So our suggestion to them was really simple. Why don't you tell them what country it comes from? There's no privacy issues on saying the IP address that you wanted is from Canada.
Mm.
There's no issue with that. Why not just tell them that? All you're doing is making it harder for police to do their job.
As we were talking, you guys, of course, tackle quite a wide range of things. And I read a few off before, but one of the ones I wanted to ask about was anti-Muslim hate. I thought it was interesting that you used the term anti-Muslim when most people would probably use the term Islamophobia.
We do that quite deliberately. Our big report on this topic, which is the largest report that's ever been done anywhere, it's called Islamophobia Online. But the only place we use that word is on the cover. And it's quite deliberately done so that people looking for Islamophobia find the report. The reason we don't like the word is because it's actually got two meanings. And we discuss this in the report. One meaning is hate against Muslims, people who are Muslim, which is a human rights violation. Okay, it's attacking the dignity of those individuals, and it's attacking their right to freedom of religion. The other place that the word Islamophobia is used is for what's called defamation of Islam. And that's something that some Muslim countries in the context of the UN have tried to make a human right, although it's actually got nothing to do with people. And that's where they try and say you can't say anything critical of the religion of Islam. You can't, you can't have the sort of religious debates and discussions which we might have in a democratic society. So because the word is used both ways, we try and avoid it.
Right, so you guys actually make very clear distinctions about what you do and do consider hate when it comes to these areas.
Yeah, it's really very, very simple. Hate that is targeting people, individuals, groups of individuals, that's hate. That's what we don't want to see. Criticism of ideas, beliefs, etc., that comes under freedom of speech. Okay, and we believe that to criticize someone's ideas is fine. There's obviously a point where you can be talking about someone's ideas, but doing it in such a way that really what you're doing is trying to attack the individual. Okay, so, there's borderline cases as well, but a lot of the time it's pretty clear cut.
So certainly, yeah, I was going to ask if you consider criticisms and at what point they're hate speech. So
I'll give you an example. This big report we did in December 2013, we released it on International Human Rights Day. It's a huge report. It looks at 50 different anti-Muslim pages on Facebook. It looks at 349 images that we collected from these 50 pages. Some of those are duplicates, the same image appearing on multiple different pages or on the same page multiple times. But there's still a lot of different images there, hundreds of them. And when we did that report, we initially put the boycott halal groups as a separate thing. We said we want to put them in this report, but these pages aren't really sharing the same sort of hateful content as the other pages, so we're not going to include them in our list of 50. When we've put out a new report a year later, we looked at the same 50 pages and we said, how many of these pages have come down? And the answer was not very many, which is an indictment on Facebook, the fact that 12 months later, the same stuff is still there. But the other thing which was interesting was a year later, we decided, you know what? We're actually going to include this anti-halal stuff in the anti-Muslim hate directly. And the reason we're going to do that is because we're seeing, even if they're keeping themselves to their anti-halal topic, and doing a good job of being very, very focused on that, the reason they're doing this quite clearly is to try and make it hard for Muslims to live in their communities. They want to get rid of the halal food from their supermarkets and from the country generally, so that it's harder for Muslim people to live their lives. And that's where it crosses over from being an objection to an idea, if you like, to being something that is practically causing difficulties for people to live their lives.
Mm. And the other one I saw was also that you guys consider some forms of criticism of Israel to be a form of anti-Semitism, but make very clearly that not at all forms. Maybe you could explain what the distinction is.
Okay, so in that case, it's actually not our definition. We use something called the working definition of anti-Semitism, which comes from what was called the European Union Monitoring Centre on Combating Racism. And the EUMC definition, racism and xenophobia, actually, the EUMC definition has two parts to it. The first one is attacking Jews generally. So, for example, it's got bullet points for different examples. The first one of those is calling for aiding or justifying the killing or harming of Jews in the name of a radical ideology or an extremist view of religion. Okay, I think we can all agree that that's anti-Semitic.
Right.
Okay. Another example, accusing Jews as a people or Israel as a state of inventing or exaggerating the Holocaust. Okay, another example, not Israel-related.
Yeah, well, that one strikes me that even if it's indirect, well, it's really, you've just changed the name, but it's the same. It's really like saying Jews, if you were to use that one.
Yep, correct. So then it gives examples that are much more closely related to Israel. So, for example, denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, for example, by claiming that the existence of a state of Israel is a racist endeavour. Okay, and that directly goes back to a UN resolution from the 1970s that said Zionism is racism, which the UN later overturned and apologised for. Okay, so that's in there as an example. Another one is drawing comparisons between contemporary Israeli policies to those of the Nazis. Okay, if you disagree with policies, fine, express your disagreement. Just don't do it with a Nazi analogy. Okay, that's what that says. There's a particular reason to avoid that in that circumstance. Another one is holding Jews collectively responsible for the actions of the State of Israel. Okay,
Jews right, which is obviously far beyond, right, of course, people all the time criticize different countries, which is, of course, yep. Fine, but...
But just to draw an analogy there, there's a lot of people, a lot of the far right, if you like, I shouldn't say a lot of people, it's a small number of people, but a lot of the far right try and portray all of the Muslims in the community as being responsible for what's going on with ISIS. Okay, so that's the same sort of thing. It's a direct analogy. Okay, the people in Australia who happen to be of a particular faith are not responsible for what other people who happen to be of the same faith do elsewhere. You know, that's like saying all Australians are responsible because there's an Australian who commits a murder.
Right.
Okay, that just makes no sense.
Right. So, okay, interesting. It's good, I think, to cover all these sort of different ones. Now, one that also struck me as quite interesting is you guys have also you consider hate against military veterans. How did you end up covering that sort of thing?
In the lead up to Anzac Day one year, there were a whole lot of pages put up, literally attacking the memory of the Anzacs. Attacking military veterans in general, saying they're all rapists and murderers, etc., etc. So we found that this was being done in an organised effort, and as soon as we got one page taken down, another one sprung up. So we ended up doing a report on that, working with the Department of Veteran Affairs, trying to talk to the RSL about it. We first had to try and explain to them why having this stuff on Facebook was an issue. They got there in the end. I think they're much more au fait with social media now than they were sort of 3 years ago. This sort of stuff causes a lot of distress for not just the veterans themselves, but their families.
Right. So the aim therein, it's obviously less about, this isn't an issue of nationalism, it's more towards the individuals who then end up getting targeted as a result?
It was more against veterans in general, but the photo on the cover of that report, for example, was actually a picture of New Zealand soldiers carrying a coffin to a funeral, to be buried. And there was literally with like Microsoft Paint, they'd gone and painted targets over all of the pallbearers and, some people in the background there, all soldiers in uniform carrying a dead comrade. Now, that sort of thing is going to cause a huge amount of distress.
Now, I wanted to ask, obviously, a big major part of what you do also is obviously homophobia, and you tackle that sort of issue. But at the same time, if you're tackling religious issues as well, I can imagine that you often have people who have conflicting levels, you know, that they might be happy to hate, happy to fight hate on one issue, but on the other hand are probably contributing to the hate.
And not too happy that we're doing something about a particular form of hate that they might disagree with. I've got to say that one is an issue. The other one, obviously, is dealing with both the anti-Semitism and the anti-Muslim hate. As soon as we deal with one, people say, well, why aren't you dealing with the other one? And as soon as you deal with that one, you get the same, the reverse. We've got 16,000 supporters on Facebook. More people are welcome to join us. Just go to facebook.com/onlinehate. Our regular supporters often speak up before we do. You know, someone will say, well, why aren't you dealing with this? And they'll say, well, they are. Haven't you seen? And they'll give them a bunch of stuff we've already done in the past on that issue.
Do you think it's maybe because maybe people joined up because they specifically saw something, but they're not necessarily so personally knowledgeable about the work that you guys do?
Look, most of the people that support us will have seen something that triggered their interest. And it's very rare that we do something, we have a video that covers a whole lot of different types of hate, but most of our work will focus on one type of hate at a time. So whatever they've seen, they know we do that. They might not know about the rest of what we do. You know, we try and encourage people to learn about, you know, the issues affecting the rest of the community. And some people come and then leave. Topic we just spoke about, the anti-veteran stuff. You know, we had a lot of people support us because of that work. And then when they saw we were doing various other things, they drift away.
Right. What sort of things are you currently engaged in doing?
As I mentioned, we're doing some work in the countering violent extremism area at the moment. So that stuff, the ISIS type stuff, the far right, Reclaim Australia type groups. That's sort of a big focus at the moment because it's high on the national agenda on both sides of that. We're also doing some work on anti-Semitism. We've just put out a big report. I haven't got a copy with me, but I have a summary of it. We looked at 2,024 items of anti-Semitism across Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. And we gathered these examples, and then we broke them down according to four categories. So the categories were traditional anti-Semitism, which was your conspiracy-type theories, blood libel, deicide, things, some of them going back centuries.
Yeah.
And that accounted for 49% of the total. We also had new anti-Semitism, which was the stuff that somehow related to Israel, such as Israel did 9/11. That was quite popular. So things like that accounted for 34%. Holocaust denial accounted for 12%. And then the category which we call promoting violence against Jews accounted for 5%. And that category could literally be a tweet saying, kill the Jews. So that report went through each of those four categories and then broke it down by platform. So we could see that the kill the Jews type stuff was mostly on Twitter, like 75% of it roughly. The Holocaust denial, maybe 60% or something, was on YouTube.
It seems so, fairly self-evident, actually, right? Short sentences go on Twitter and longer, more elaborate conspiracies have to go on YouTube.
Well, yeah, that's part of it. There's two factors. The one is what platform people choose to put the content on. And as you say, there's a bias for certain types of content to go on certain platforms. The other side of it is how the platforms respond. So the platforms, because the sort of things you see on Twitter, you could also get on Facebook. Okay, there's no reason not to. Videos can be uploaded to Facebook as well as YouTube. Okay, so there's no reason that you can't have that sort of crossover. So part of it is what's going up and where it goes up. And the other part is how the platforms deal with it to take it down. You know, one of the things we're now doing, updating this report, is we've seen that about 10% of the stuff that we recorded as being on Facebook has now come down after 12 weeks. That's not so great, actually. But on the other hand, none of the stuff on YouTube has come down.
Okay. Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, you know, 12 weeks should be plenty of time for them to act. We're talking to the platforms, and we have to do a balancing act now. We have to decide whether it's more important to get this content taken down and to just give them the list of what we know about, or is it more important to have this sample as a measure of the wider picture for all the things we don't know about to say, well, what percentage are they dealing with?
So many of these reports aren't you, and it's not you personally, let's say, sitting at the computer. My understanding is that it's really almost anyone can really report. So how can people get involved?
Okay, so one of our flagship project, one of the things we do, is a piece of software called Fight Against Hate. So you can find it at fightagainsthate.com, and anyone can go and register. It's free to register. And you then report the hate you see. You just take the web address, the URL from Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, whatever it is, paste it into the submit field, hit go, And then it asks you what sort of hate is it and how certain you are that it is that type of hate. Hmm. If you choose something like anti-Semitism, for example, it then gives you a breakdown and says, which of these four categories is it? Okay, so those are the ones I read out to you before. It does the same for other categories. That data goes into a giant database, which we're making available to academic researchers, to government agencies, to researchers in different places, also to police, also to community organisations. So those people that need access to it will have access to the data, but they won't know who reported it. They'll just know that this item is in the system, and maybe it will tell you that, for example, 50 people have reported it. Okay, and it was first reported at this date. Okay, so anyone can get involved, and the more data we get across all the different types of hate, including things like homophobia, the more reports we can produce and the more of a complete picture we'll have of what's out there.
So this can cover things obviously like homophobia, but also religious type issues like what you call Muslim hate or anti-Muslim hate. People would usually refer to it as Islamophobia, but as we covered there, there's a specific reason why you've renamed it. But also quite a few, even just, does that also constitute under the more just bullying and griefing?
Yeah, there's a category for bullying as well. The subcategories, if you choose bullying, or whether it's bullying against you, if you're the victim, whether it's bullying against someone you know, or whether it's bullying you've just observed. Okay, so yeah, we do capture that information too. Our next step is to talk to people like the government, like other organisations, other NGOs, to say to them, okay, how can we integrate the data we're getting with the people that can then deal with it and respond and give people the support they need? And that's really the next step we're working on. The software was only launched in December, so it's relatively new.
I wanted to just mention griefing because I saw that was the last one. I thought it was a bit funny that you've put that one up. For those that don't know, griefing is generally a video gaming term. It's usually for multiplayer online where people are doing things. I guess it's the equivalent of, if you were playing basketball and someone just keeps throwing the ball into their like own hoop or something like that, just to be really annoying. That's sort of where it derives from. But obviously, I don't think you're using that kind of annoying thing to refer to it.
No, we are. We've taken it directly from the gaming world. Rather than basketball, a typical example would be, let's say, a game where you're building star fleets. And there's really cheap vehicles that don't cost very much, that you can build lots of them. You start off at your basic level with no resources. Okay, you've got some player that's invested a year getting themselves upgraded to the point where they've got this really powerful, fancy battleship. And then a whole group of people decide, you know what, we're going to create new accounts that we don't care if we lose them. And we're just going to run suicide missions against this, you know, this fancy ship. And if we get 200 of us to do it at once, we're going to destroy them, right? And all the effort this person's put in is being wiped out by someone that's not actually playing the game by the same rules, okay? They're not actually trying to achieve the same goal. They don't care if they destroy themselves as long as they cause this other person trouble. So in our context, we're actually not talking about games. We're talking about destroying the experience online for someone that might be, you know, a Facebook user. Okay, now if you're griefing someone on Facebook and trying to make it, or on Twitter, the other example, every time they log in, there's 1,000 people that have been tweeting at them with abuse. Okay, that's a form of griefing. Now, each of those people may only be sending one tweet, okay, one comment on Facebook, one post on a page, okay, but it all adds up. Okay, minimum effort from many, many people can actually drive the individual being targeted to suicide.
Right. So it's actually that. So that's, and so it's quite similar, I guess, to the bullying example in some ways.
It's a form of bullying, if you like, but distributed bullying. So it's not one person investing a huge amount of effort to cause somebody grief. Instead, it's a lot of people, because they think it's funny or for some other reason, investing 5 minutes.
Right, I see. I can understand how that can have quite an impact. But look, Andre, I've really enjoyed the time that we've had with you. I think it's been very interesting. Once again, you said that people can get involved online. That's at Fight Against Hate.
Yep, fightagainsthate.com is the reporting platform. And to join us on Facebook, facebook.com/onlinehate. Our Twitter handle is also @onlinehate. It's interesting when we go to conferences and we get badges that say we're from Online Hate.
And everyone's like, you're the people who have been sending us all those messages.
Yeah, we get a bit of that.
And also, of course, there's the Online Hate Prevention Institute.
Yeah, there's the website at ohpi.org.au, which people can go to, and it's got little buttons with all the different categories we cover. There's also a sign-up place for our newsletter. We send that out about once a month, and we actually try and achieve a little bit of balance covering multiple issues. Sometimes we'll have a whole newsletter that mostly focuses on one issue because we can get caught up in something big that's going on.
And we've come to the end of another episode of The Spirit Lounge on Joy 94.9. I had someone write in just saying, great show, looking forward to having the online team back next year to see how things have progressed. I really do hope that things keep progressing there. And of course, the great way, if you do, like we said, if you do want to make sure that things are progressing, you can join the fight against hate, right? You go fightagainsthate.com. We'd love to see definitely more people there. I think it's absolutely wonderful. So thanks so much, Andre, for being on the show.
Thank you, Tol, for having me.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.